Welcome to On a Mission, the show where you get to listen to inspired and inspiring people talk about their lives and their purpose. In other words, their mission in the world. You're listening to episode 7. Dr. Kelly McElhaney is the founding director of the Center for Equity, Gender, and Leadership at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. She started her career in banking, which she calls a heavily masculine industry, where women were compelled to exercise leadership in a masculine way. And now she's fighting the good fight in the corporate world to insist that, yes, welcoming different skill sets, different personalities, different genders, and different ethnicities into the boardroom is not just a nice thing to do, but that it is, in fact, good for the bottom line, something business types like to hear. She's the author of a book called Just Good Business. You can find the link to that in the show notes at my blog, MaulineDupreeDominguez.com. I think you'll be intrigued by what she has observed about imposter syndrome and how it affects men and women differently. And wait till you hear what she has to say about being an ally. Listen in to get inspired about positive possibilities in the corporate world.
My name is Kelly McElhaney, and I am a professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley and also the founder of the new Center for Equity, Gender, and Leadership.
Yes. Let's start, I guess, with the founding of the Center for Equity, Gender, and Leadership. How did you come to establish this institution?
And I would say it existed in my mind for a little bit too long, both because I hadn't really led with my gender. I had led much more with my sort of role in life as a mother, as a professor, and trying to fit in to the gender norms that were set for me. So it existed in my mind. And when I proposed it, given the time, my superiors, my dean and so forth, didn't think that there was a lot of value or linkage to the business world. And then my mentor, role model, and friend, Sheryl Sandberg, wrote her book, Lean In. And so I was able to kind of go in through the vast door that she opened up through that book. And then the real thing, because I work at a public institution and everything comes down to funding, is that I was able to raise a significant amount of money in one luncheon from about originally 9 of our female and 1 male alums, and then get a great support in 2 companies, Gap Inc. and Zendesk, which gave me the funding to go ahead and launch the center.
Wow. Take me back, if you would, to that lunch. Were you meaning to come away with like all the funding you would need pretty much from that one lunch?
No, it's a great question, and it gives me chills. My dean said, look, I need to see proof of concept. So this was probably in late April. He said, if you can bring in $1 million by June 15th, I'll quote unquote let you start this center. So with a team at Haas, I cannot take full credit. It was with a team. We brought together 24, I would say high net worth women, most of whom were alums. So they had a deep connection to the school. Mm-hmm. And I gave a pitch. The woman who hosted us at the Battery had already come in as an investor, and I call them investors, not donors. I think the nonprofit world does a disservice by acting as if these people are just throwing money at us. I really think my board and investors are investing in me and my team to create change.
Yeah.
So we had this lunch. The hostess, Karen, gave a good intro. I gave a talk about sort of the state and context of women in leadership, women in business. Karen again stood up and said, I'm in. Who else is in? And it was actually unbelievable. And I don't spend a lot of time, so it's a great time for me to be present in that moment. Hands were raised and people said, I'm in. And, you know, once people were in and some said, look, I can't be in now. Give me time. It's not the right time. I believe in what you're doing. Keep me posted. And then a few women who couldn't attend that day came in the next week. And I went to the dean a month ahead of time and said, I have $1,000,001. So let's go.
Yes.
And it just goes to show you the fervor with which women are resonating with this issue right now, are coming to grips with the amount of discrimination and worse that they've experienced and survived, because they are all incredibly successful women in their own right. And just sort of this sense of impatience and a point in history where we're saying enough.
Yeah. Yep.
And I do have a few male donors as well. The CEO of Gap Inc., who was incredibly supportive from the start, is a male. We had one male alum, and then a few of our corporate partners, they come in just at a bit of a lower level, have some men who are leading diversity and inclusion, and they become a board member once they support us.
Yeah. Awesome. Congratulations on that meeting and all the success that has come since. Just for our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with some of these terms, could you talk about what equity means in your context?
Sure. And we chose the word equity really purposefully. I mean, equality is a little bit more into the human rights and civil rights and things that exist and are very necessary to kick it into equity. But since we are a business school, we really needed to focus on where business can create change. So when we talk about equity, it really starts with things like equal access to get in the door, which actually women are enjoying a fair bit of equal access getting into the door at equal rates as men in entry level positions inside of a leadership. But it's equity on salary, which is the first place I would say it starts, because the best equity is to pay us the same as you're paying men in similar positions, similar levels.
Mm-hmm.
It's equity in terms of entrance into the upper levels. It's equity in terms of the entrance into networks and where deals are going down, who's talking to whom, who's taking who to lunch.
Mm.
And then ultimately equity into the senior levels in which we need to be received the same way as men, even though we might lead differently, not better, but differently. And the acceptance and respect for those who lead differently. And it's not always women. You know, there are lots of different men who are introverts or men of different ethnicities who haven't been brought up in this very hyper-masculinized way. So one thing I want to stress about my center is we go beyond gender. So we go into race, ethnicity, gender as a spectrum, socioeconomic status. So first in family, because we're a university, to get into college, let alone graduate school at a place like the Haas School of Business.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of like an example of when you're talking about exhibiting leadership qualities in a different way, or like sort of managing to be a leader through a non-traditional method? Can you think of somebody that you've worked with who does that?
Well, that's a tough question for me, because I happen to exist in a pretty masculine world where women, to be successful, and I don't fault the women, come from banking, so women very much had to lead in a masculine way. I hate to say it, but for the most part, I found a similar type of leadership. But I would say that in my dealings with corporate America, here's an example. Nancy Green, who up until a month ago was the CEO and president of Athleta, which is one of the Gap Inc. brands.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
She just left to become an executive at Old Navy, which Gap Inc. is spinning off into its old company. Or sorry, which Gap Inc. is spinning off into its own company.
Yeah, I had heard that. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's really complicated. But Nancy is a woman who was one of the few women throughout her trajectory in Gap Inc. and Athleta who had children and remained at work. I believe she has three or four children. So that's a full-time Whoa. Load at home.
Yes.
She unabashedly would leave work at 5 to go be with her family, to always be home for dinner, very unapologetically, but still managed to get her job done. She's highly committed to kind of soul-centering activities in her own life, like yoga and exercise. And I think through that, role modeled a different way of leadership than men who will stay until all hours at work. Maybe not. What I've learned is over time, they may leave work but not tell anybody they're leaving work, and they may find their own balance in life but just don't show and role model that. Whereas Nancy was very purposely a role model to employees, men and women, who reported into her. I remember she told me a story once that one of her male employees came back from a newly granted paternity leave and thanked her for, you know, having paternity leave. And she's like, don't thank me. That's your right.
Yeah.
That is not something. It was just, you know, I really respect the way she has led. And now she's also run a very purpose-driven company in Athleta. She's taken Athleta into B Corp, which is a very, it's a for benefit corporation, which is an explicit statement that they exist to do more than just return a financial value. It really is a mentor to me and a role model.
Yeah. And I know that that was a big point in the Lean In book, was Sheryl Sandberg's point about explicitly leaving work, having family time, and then perhaps later in the evening re-engaging with work that needed to be done. But however she did it, getting the work done and being present to her family was a big goal for her.
Yeah. And even just kind of following Sheryl's trajectory after her husband, you know, very tragically died while on vacation. Her second book, Option B, one of the things I love about that book is she decouples the sense that you can be powerful and you can also show vulnerability. So in other words, she decouples the sense that you can't be vulnerable and powerful at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to resonate towards male and female leaders who show vulnerability publicly, because it's difficult as a male in a hyper-masculinized world. They're not supposed to show vulnerability, and women have been very much trained that to be successful, I know the business world the best. So in the business world, they can't show vulnerability. It's deemed a sign of weakness. And Sheryl said after her husband died and, you know, she returned to work, she couldn't help but being vulnerable. I know it makes me want to cry too. She couldn't help but being vulnerable and start crying in a meeting. And I do remember she credited Mark Zuckerberg, who, you know, obviously her CEO, for saying, it's okay, cry. So I really, that's something I struggle with teaching women. I don't struggle. I very much adhere to teaching women this, even my own daughters, because they've already been taught, you're too emotional, you're too dramatic. And I really push them back and say, have you ever told a man that they are too emotional and too dramatic? Because guess what? Life's very emotional.
Yep.
So it's a little sad to me that they're already indoctrinated into believing that that's a sign of weakness. Nancy Green, just having left Athleta, said she was asked to go and do some purposeful things at Old Navy because Athleta was her baby and she thought she'd kind of retire there. And I was so impressed when she said, I cried in front of my CEO and my board member who very much asked me to do this. And I thought, again, that was just so real of her.
Yeah. I mean, it's very human, right? It's humanizing,
yeah, exactly,
to show emotions and to show vulnerability in an inappropriate amount for the workplace,
right?
To acknowledge that we are human beings, not just cogs.
Yeah. You brought up a really great word. It's appropriately. You can't come to work crying and being vulnerable every day. You have to be, you know, there's a time and a place. And vulnerability doesn't always mean crying. Sometimes it just means saying, I'm having a really rough day.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, being a full-time working mom, it's tough. So that younger women can say, oh, it's not just me who's experiencing it. But look, she's a president and she thinks it's tough, but she's still doing it, which means I can hack it. I can stay in and do it. You can be what you can see. So
another word that you use a lot in your institution is inclusion. And I mean, I know we were talking about equity in terms of being access to the door. Can you talk a little bit about inclusion once people get in the door?
Yeah, so the adage, and I think I used it when I came to talk to your students, is diversity is counting heads. So of course, we have to get diverse demographics and ethnicities and genders in the door. But inclusion is actually making those heads count. You just can't count the heads if they're leaving at faster rates, which is what we're seeing in certain industries like technology. So inclusion is giving folks the right to be different, to bring diverse lived experiences and perspectives. I'll just bring up one that's very poignant for me given the last week and what's been happening. But you could imagine after Gilroy or El Paso, that folks who come from a Mexican heritage do not feel the same as I do, who comes from a, you know, American, I'm indigenously American. So it is allowing for example, a Mexican employee to come to work after the shootings in El Paso and needing to talk about how they're feeling, not expecting that they can just dive into work that day, whereas if it's business as usual, that's inclusion.
Yeah.
So maybe taking a moment to say, you know, how are you feeling today? I want to hear what's going on for you right now. How can we support you through what's happening in our country?
Yes. Go ahead.
Sorry, there are just so many examples of inclusion. I hear from African-American females that they feel that they need to straighten their hair to look very much like the Europeans, you know, Eurocentric white female. They've been told in more conservative sectors like finance to straighten their hair, and that is not inclusion if they can't come to work as they authentically are. I have heard gay men who have felt that they need to be closeted remain closeted and have pictures on their desk of them and their sister to look like they're in a heteronormative relationship. So it is kind of allowing people to uncover who they authentically are so that they feel included, or introverts. So I just don't want to always bring this around to gender or race. Introverts not feeling like they have to answer every question or raise their hand first or speak loudly or pound their fists on the table.
Mm-hmm. To have their contributions be valued or be taken seriously.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's interesting when you look around, opportunities for inclusion abound. And a lot of us who have been traditionally in the mainstream are blind to them because, like, I can say myself as an extrovert and a outspoken person, I'm always the first one to raise my hand. And I have to really stop and think about people for whom processing takes a little bit longer.
Yeah, that's a really great example. One of my good friends and faculty colleagues at Haas, a female, she's in the finance department, which is heavily male dominated. And in fact, research shows that MBA students, females, tend to participate at lower rates in finance classes, and you can observably check that data. So she implemented a really, what sounds like a small strategy in the classroom, and it had profound effects. It's the 10-second rule. So she will ask a question and her students cannot raise their hand or speak for 10 seconds.
Ooh.
And she has seen a markedly different pattern amongst who's participating and raising their hands and speaking in the classroom, such that men are not dominating. Women are speaking up more. Mm-hmm. And I suspect you can't really judge who's an introvert and who's an extrovert, you know, sort of empirically or, you know, whatever, statistically, if they don't self-report, but she just had a different level of participation, which suggests that people with different styles are participating at higher rates and feeling comfortable and included.
I'm sure. Right. And feeling honored for their contribution, because it's not like they're fighting for airtime.
Right.
With people who just think more quickly or speak more loudly or have been told their opinions are more valuable.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, in your experience, are some of the top structures in the business world that can exclude marginalized people?
I think the concept of fit, you hear that word a lot in the business world. We hire for fit. And when I hear that, first of all, it's a huge red flag to me, because fit generally tends to mean somebody like me. Like, mm-hmm. likes, like, you know, the psychological phenomenon of homophily, like, likes, like. And if I were seated, when I have been seated around a table of 10 managers and they use the word fit, I say, hey, can you describe fit? And I'll probably amongst 10 managers get 40 characteristics. So there is no definition of fit. So that's one of the huge dangers. And it's quite prevalent, particularly in the Bay Area with Silicon Valley, venture capital and technology. They invest in fit. They hire for fit. It's also, you know, where you tend to see the data stacked. Again, it's on pay equity, and I can't say enough about that. But it's around performance appraisals and how women, the three words that are only ever used negatively about women are aggressive, abrasive, and bossy.
Mm.
A man who's seen as aggressive is, he's great. He's going to reach his numbers. He's going to take us, you know, he's going to hit a home run. A woman who's aggressive, she's seen as cold and unlikable. So it's really looking at the words that we use to describe men and women or people of color and white people differently, even though it's the same word and the same attribute.
Yeah.
Where else am I thinking structurally? It's you know, I think it's also the fact that women and people of color feel less, they don't feel less confident in their own abilities, but they feel less confident that they'll be able to cross the significant amount of barriers to reach to, you know, reach to the top. Mm. And so it's, and I don't always want to put white men on the sort of on the docket here, but it's for people who are in the dominant culture in any organization or department to put their backing, or, you know, behind a person of color or a woman and say, look, let's give her or him a chance. I'll put my word behind them that they can do this. And sort of this concept of tell her she's ready, because she's been told in so many ways since a young girl that she's not ready, she's not enough, she should shrink, she shouldn't take computer science, coding, or math classes. So we have this adage in my class called hashtag tell her she's ready. And it's just really powerful. And I do it with my female friends and colleagues all the time. They'll come to me and say, hey, there's this job that I'm looking at, and or there's this promotion, but look at this job description. I can't do this, and I don't think I can do this. I'm like, wait, why don't we reframe this? What can you do? What are the things on here that you've already done? And yep. The things you don't think you can do, how much do you feel confident that you can learn them? And just flipping kind of the paradox and the context.
You bet. I've had 3 conversations like that in the last month with friends. And I often remark to them, a man would not think twice about applying for this job, whether or not he hits all of the bullet points of what they're looking for. Just says, I'll be able to figure that out.
Yeah, or I'll delegate.
Sure. Or they're asking for 10 to 15 years experience. I have 7, close enough.
Exactly.
As a woman is saying, well, I have 18. Do you think that'd be okay?
Which is another good structural barrier. Companies need to look at their job descriptions, because we've all been there. When we're writing a job description, we were like, oh my gosh, it's wide open. I need these 17 things. And then do you really? Because nobody is going, God is not even going to,
yes,
you know, possess those 17 things. So what are the 5 things that are most critical?
There you go. And
I can't say I am looking for somebody with 3 years of experience and a world-class coder, because I don't believe there's a woman in the world who would say, I have 3 years experience, I'm world-class.
Right. Yeah. We have that in education too. We make job descriptions that, yes, God would
nobody
not be able to fulfill all the time. It sounds, as I'm hearing you talk, I hear echoes of this phenomenon that I've heard called imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Do you talk about that in your classroom? Do you give that a lot of weight? What's your experience with this so-called imposter syndrome?
Well, I always start from an evidence-based model, because I'm trained as an academician and PhD and researcher. So the research does say that women are much more likely to suffer from imposter syndrome. The 2 times that you see it peak or spike is after they've been given a promotion, or after they've received some sort of an honor or award. It's this concept of, oh my gosh, they're gonna find out that I'm not that good. Mm. Or wait, why am I seated at this table? But anecdotally, when I've taught this in my classroom, I have had several men raise their hand and say, I feel the same way. But I think it's that vulnerability piece where they just don't admit it. They don't let themselves think it. And they so immediately get all of these pats on their back that it just escapes faster from their purview, where, you know, I think there is a level of doubt after a woman's been promoted, and a sense from folks in the dominant group, hey, she took something that was by she took something that was by birthright mine.
Mm-hmm.
It's like death by 1,000 cuts. She gets lots of subtle hints.
Yep. That only enhance that feeling or allow it to stick around and feed it, huh?
Yeah, and especially now, because we're living in a world more and more where quotas are being set. So in the state of California, companies need to move towards having 30% women on boards, which I happen to believe is the right thing to do. But what it does is it further makes women feel like, oh, I've just been appointed to this board because I'm a woman, and they need to reach their quota. Whereas the fact is, you're a good woman. So yeah, you should be on this board, quota or no quota. They should have been thinking about this sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting facet of imposter syndrome that I really haven't heard, that men may also experience it, but it does not live as long in their bodies or in their minds because of the myriad of forces and individuals who affirm that indeed they can do this.
And they deserve to be there. Like, dude, you've worked so hard for this. Congrats. I mean, I've been waiting for this to happen. The other thing I want to mention, because I'm always very careful to try not to blame anybody. We're all to blame. What if there's a great adage I learned, everybody's guilty, no one's to blame. And there's a high level of self-bias. So you look at this phenomenon in the business world. I don't know if it exists in the educational world, but they're called 360 reviews. So somebody above you reviews you, somebody below you, somebody at the same level, and yourself. And the data shows that for men, when they do their self-review, and if others above, beside, or below rate them lower, they tend to brush it off and say, well, that person's never really worked for me, or that person's just jealous, or, you know, poo-poo, I'm not going to believe that. Whereas women will do their self-review, and if people outside of them review them lower, they'll adjust their self-review. So women are very affected by what those around us think or how they rate us. So self-bias is a really, I think, pernicious thing that we have to continuously fight against, and it's hard.
Yeah. How do you address that with your students, if you do?
I do. I think, you know, all I can really do is raise their awareness. I teach in a business school where we think data reigns supreme, which I sort of laugh at, even though I have to adhere to that model. It's exactly a situation of very masculine, oh, I need to see the data first. So I always start with that data, and the data's there. I make them aware, and then it goes more towards how can we support one another to say, hey, you deserve to be here. That's mm-hmm. that hashtag, you're ready.
Yeah.
Amplify their amplify their qualities or their track record or success. Because at the end of the day, inclusion is around including others and really serving as allies for others, such that they also reciprocate and serve as allies for ourselves when we need it.
Ooh, that's good. Talk a little bit about being an ally.
And that's complicated because we live in a world now where, well, I shouldn't say in a world. I exist in a context where everybody wants to say I'm an ally. Of course I'm an ally. Yes, I'm an ally. And one of the gentle questions I will follow that sort of assertion with is, what was the last active allyship move that you have made? Because it's easy to say you're an ally. But what have you actually done with your actions, your voice, your power to be an ally? And we talked about this past semester, and I had some incredibly thoughtful students from whom I learned a lot. I know you experienced this too, but they made me a better professor. But one woman raised her hand and very quietly said, I don't suppose you can call yourself an ally. I suppose it's when another person thanks you. And tells you what you just did, then that's when you become an ally. It's not really a self-proclaimed attribute.
Oh, that is so good. I'm writing.
Yep, and again, that's from one of my students. I have to give credit where credit is due. And she was a really quiet, introverted student. So it was so brilliant when she spoke up. Everybody was just riveted. And
I love it.
And in fact, that got repeated a lot throughout the semester. It really had a profound impact on all of us.
Yeah. So being an ally is not a title you give yourself, but it's really something, a title that others give you. And you know,
yep, perfect.
When they say thank you.
Much better way to say it. It's bestowed upon you by others.
Yeah. Oh, that is so good. Especially, like you said, in this day and age where everyone wants to, I mean, I think for good and bad reasons, but wants to proclaim themselves an ally to all humanity. And I love it.
Of course I support everybody.
Sure, but then when it costs us something or means that we have to stick our necks out or put our reputations on the line, then it's a little bit harder to say that we're being allies.
And not to go into a controversial topic, but just conversation with you, I was very, let's just say, watchful of the whole Colin Kaepernick taking a knee.
Oh,
I'm
good.
A huge football fan.
Yes, let's do it.
He was, I was impressed with how silent he was. He never garnered he never asked for press or spoke to the press. He got press, but never, you know, brought it on himself or did press interviews. But he did one interview when he received an NAACP award.
Mm.
And he stood up there, was incredibly impressed on so many levels, but he said nothing about himself. He talked about his teammate, Eric Reed, who had everything to lose and still took a knee with him. And I thought that's the definition of an ally. Like you just said, somebody who has risk of losing something and takes a knee or stands up or uses his voice or his title anyway. And one of my mantras through my center and in my classroom and in any keynote that I ever give in the corporate sector is silence is complicity. And so many of us have remained silent so many times in our life, particularly the higher risk of the situation.
Yep.
And I really want people to, can't teach them, I can't really teach courage to use their voice, but I can teach them to re-engage with their voice and their privilege. Talk a lot about privilege in my class, and it can be a jarring word because there's a lot of white guilt and we don't want to admit we have privilege. But if you don't, one of the things I say to my students, and again, I've said this in your classroom, but if you've never had to think about it, that's a sign of privilege.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. We call that an immunity in my classroom, you know, when you're immune to something bad, somebody say stopping you on the street for no reason, or you're immune to people pointing at you when you're holding hands with your partner and laughing.
Yeah,
And that's the aspect of privilege that I find most challenging to teach because it's not happening. And so how do you see something that's not happening? It's a very specific muscle, I think.
Careers aren't straightforward or ladders, particularly for women. They tend to be more circuitous.
Yeah, boy, is that true or what? And I wish that we could get that message to more women, because how many women do I run into who feel inadequate, falling short, just inferior because their career is not this straight up the ladder situation, but it's this spiral and that doesn't move at the same pace throughout the whole time, and that's just how it is.
So, all right. Thank you. Thank you very much,
Kelly.
Thanks for listening to On a Mission. I hope you took something from my conversation with Kelly. I will continue to ponder ways I can send the message to my girl students and to my daughter. You are ready. Embrace the opportunities that come your way and don't push them away for fear of being unprepared. You are ready. You can find links and resources to what Kelly talked about on my website, MarleneDupreeDominguez.com. And let's make it easier for other folks to find this podcast and get inspired for their missions. Please go on to Apple Podcasts and leave a written review along with a rating. This helps other people find us. And share the podcast with your friends and your family. Thanks for all your support. Have a beautiful week.